Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Calvin Trillin is our guest this hour. I've been looking forward and having a great time reading his new book, which is a compilation of writings that he's done over 40 years. Isn't that something? 40 years. He's written for The New Yorker, of course, for The Nation. He's done one-man off-Broadway shows. And he's written many, many books, just to give you a sampling. Trillin on Texas, Deciding the Next Decider, about Alice, his dear wife. And he wrote an absolutely, if you haven't read this book, it is so beautiful, about Alice. His current book is dedicated to the memory of Alice. She appears, as he says, in a character in many of these pieces before her death. In 2001, even the pieces that didn't mention her were written in the hope of making her giggle. A lovely dedication. He's written, Obliviously on He Sails, Tepper Isn't Going Out, Messages from My Father, American Stories, If You Can't Say Something Nice, which I just found in the house last night, Uncivil Liberties, Alice, Let's Eat. A lot of his writing is about eating, too, and many other books. And he's with us this hour. I forgot to say the name of his latest book, which I should, right? 40 years of funny stuff it is. It's Quite Enough of Calvin Trillin. And I think the last time we spoke with him was about Stubbs Terkel some time ago. And he was gracious enough to share his memories of that wonderful man who I miss very much. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Calvin. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. I believe Calvin is at the Main Library in Philadelphia. Is that where you are? Hi, Calvin.
Yes, it is.
You're at the Main Library in Philadelphia.
Right.
A nice place, is it?
It is, yes.
I like
the Library of Philadelphia.
Yeah, I like libraries. They're good places, aren't they?
Yes, I'm actually the trustee of the New York Public Library, which is one of the great cultural institutions in the city.
Yeah. So I was thinking a lot about Kansas City and about New York in reading many of your pieces in the book. Do you say, when people ask you, and you're in some far-flung place like Paris, when they ask you where you're from, do you say Kansas City, really? Is it still in your heart, or are you from New York now?
Sometimes I say I live in New York. I never say I'm from New York. I think of myself as a resident out-of-towner. I've lived there permanently since 1961, but I'm from Kansas City, really. I remember one of my daughters said to me when she got old enough, "Why do you tell people I'm from Kansas City? I was born in New York and I've always lived in New York." And I said, if an American diplomat's child is born in Paris, the child is not French.
Isn't it good you were born in Kansas City? I mean, just think of it.
Well, yeah, it's a wonderful break, of course.
Right, right.
As I say in the book, a lot of people claim to be from Kansas City when they're not, just for the prestige.
I understand.
I really am from Kansas City.
I know. Yeah, you are. I love the collection here. There's just so much. And we have to talk about the Milwaukee connection. Actually, we tried to nail down this person, but we ran out of time yesterday and couldn't find him. I had no idea, and I should ask you to do this, although I know you've given it up, your talent of whistling and humming at the same time, but you packed it in when you met this neurologist from Milwaukee.
That's
at
right.
A book signing some years ago.
Yeah, that used to be my talent in the sense of when the people in the Miss America contest say Miss Minnesota will now do her talent. If I had been in the Miss America contest, I would have hummed and whistled at the same time. But I mentioned that I could do this in a book. And then when I was in Milwaukee on a book tour, I was in a bookstore about to give a reading, and two couples walked in, and they said that one of their number, who, as I remember, was the head of a neurology department in one of the hospitals or maybe one of the universities. I don't think that had anything to do with his talent. They said he could hum and whistle at the same time also, so they suggested that the two of us might want to do a quartet. But then it turned out that he could hum one tune while whistling another tune. As I remember, he could hum "I'm in the Mood for Love" while whistling "Goodnight, Irene."
Astounding.
So I gave it up at that point.
Oh, I wish you hadn't, because a lot of people wouldn't have known about him.
Well, my only talent remaining, I guess, is parallel parking.
You know how to do that well?
Yes.
Good for you.
Yeah, I think that's what I would do now if they said Miss Minnesota will now do her talent.
It's a hard thing to learn how to do. It's amazing how many people comment on that person's a bad parallel parker every single day.
I actually wrote a novel about parking and called Tepper Isn't Going Out. And I'm not here to boast, Kathleen, of course, but I believe it's the first parking novel ever written.
I haven't read it, I must say. I read your current book. Should I read it next?
Sure. It would be a good thing, particularly if you're going to New York and need a parking space.
Do you drive in New York?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You do?
I think that's part of the Kansas City thing. I mean, it's pretty hard to give up your car. And I don't have to be convinced by people who say it's much more economical to do without a car in New York, rent a car when you need one, et cetera, et cetera. You don't have all the expenses of the garage and the insurance. They're absolutely right, but it's my car and I'm not giving it up.
You reminded me, I don't know what brought my mother to mind so frequently in reading some of these, but you reminded me of my mother frequently, particularly...
I remind a lot of people of mothers.
You do? Well, let's talk about food and your mother, but also about this very funny piece. And I remember chicken a la King. My mom loved to make that dish, and we'd have it probably every other week, and she thought of it as a really fancy dish. She was a heck of a cook. But chicken a la King, the country used to be awash in it.
Country did used to be awash in it, and there are probably some of your listeners of a certain age who never heard of it because it disappeared at one point.
Yes.
It used to be not only a specialty of some domestic cooks, but also it was what was served at the Kiwanis Club, chicken a la King.
Right.
And when I was reporting pieces around the country every 3 weeks for The New Yorker, I was often at a Kiwanis Club meeting, so often that I actually knew the Kiwanis song. I'd rather be a Kiwanian than in any other club. And I made up a verse for Chicken a la King, which was, "There's nothing can defeat us, whatever life may bring, because we can go and eat us some chicken a la King. I'd rather be a Kiwanian than in any other club." But the interesting thing about chicken a la King, it was sort of a multi-regional, multi-class dish, because on debutante parties on the North Shore of Long Island, and I know some of your listeners are wondering how would he know about debutante parties on the North Shore of Long Island, but I went to Yale, and those people were sort of thick on the ground at Yale at that point. They all had three last names. My roommate's name was Thatcher Baxter Hatcher, and they all had little names like Mutt and Biff and Skip.
Sure.
We called him Tush Hatcher, and they would take me to the debutante parties because there was shortage of males, so if you had a tuxedo and a pulse, you could go no matter how scruffy your background was.
And you sure had a tuxedo. That's another story.
I did have a tuxedo.
Right.
And then about midnight, they had what they called supper, which was 8 or 9 hours after people in Kansas City had had supper. We tried to get everybody fed before dark in Kansas City. These enormously snotty-looking waiters would come out with silver trays and silver bowls, and in the bowl was chicken a la King. And there's even a theory that goop that chicken a la King floats around in, if it's allowed to react with silver, particularly if the silver's been in the family for more than two generations, can cause the teeth to bond together, and that that's why those people on the North Shore of Long Island talk like this with their mouth. They can't open them from eating chicken a la king.
Oh, it makes me want to cook up some chicken a la king. It really does. I want to find out exactly what was in it.
Somebody sent me a can of it. I think it was a Swanson's chicken a la king. This has been some years ago.
Oh, so you could use a refill. Need more.
It still exists, I guess.
Uh-huh. All right. Did you feel kind of out of place being this guy from Kansas City with these, you know, this wonderful family, and there you are at Yale? Was it a hard experience or not?
No, it was sort of funny, really. I mean, my father, who didn't go to college, had read a book called Stover at Yale when he was a boy, and he decided that I would be going to Yale. So that's what happened. And I remember the first couple of days I was there, my roommate, Thatcher Baxter Hatcher, said that after the war, his family no longer dressed for dinner. And I thought that meant they could come down in their undershirts and everything. So my mom would never allow that, Tosh. And we're talking about Kansas City here. So it was a kind of a culture shock for a while, but it was interesting for me.
Did you like it?
Oh, I loved it. Yeah.
Uh huh.
I actually had a happy childhood all the way through college, which, as I say in the book, puts me at somewhat a disadvantage in writing memoir, since memoir now in America is sort of an atrocity arms race, and you have to think of some hideous secret family, like at least incest, or maybe bestiality, or maybe incestuous bestiality, or something like that. Some glue-sniffing grandmother, or family tapeworm, or some awful thing. And I had a really pretty happy childhood.
Yeah, you did. Well, you also had a childhood that gave you great stories. Why don't you tell us about... Well, first of all, well, no, maybe at the end we'll find out if this means anything. Your father having people in the car trying to spell, do you pronounce it Yifniff?
Yeah, Yifniff.
Yifniff.
Yifniff was, when he took us to Boy Scout meeting, we had a drive, it was some way, and he had a list of prizes he would give to anybody who could spell Yifniff. And... occasionally, somebody in the car would say, but it's your word. And he'd say, that's right, that's why I know how to spell it. And they'd say, what does it mean? He said, it doesn't mean anything, it's just to be spelled. And, of course, in theory, all these things he was going to give us, like a free pair of shoes and a lifetime pass to the Kansas City Blues baseball game, and free piano lessons for a year. I mean,
right, that was
really
big.
That.
Right.
At any rate, we all tried to spell Yifniff. I think it was my cousin Keith who was a finalist in the Kansas State Spelling Bee. Thought of YYGH, I remember. My father would just say, wrong, next. And see, people say, well, you could make it up. You could, but my father's views on honesty made the Boy Scouts look sort of wishy-washy. So I was certain that if anybody really spelled it, they would get all the prizes.
The apple didn't fall too far in your case. Am I correct?
Well, I'm sort of strict about I remember when I wrote a book about my father, and I mentioned in the book that most people's childhoods, when you hear them talk about their childhood, can be summed up in a sentence, like, we come from a noble family and you must never do anything to besmirch its name, or we're miserable because your father deserted us, or something like that. And when I thought about what theme I wanted for my own daughter's childhoods, and they grew up in Greenwich Village, I decided that the theme was, despite all evidence to the contrary, you're being raised in Kansas. City.
But your wife, Alice, warned you about perhaps being a little bit too much of a smart aleck, right?
Constantly, to no effect. Yes, she did.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Calvin Trillin is our guest this hour in his latest book. I highly recommend it. It's just lovely. Quite enough of Calvin Trillin, 40 years of funny stuff. And it's all over the board funny stuff. Of course, it's political. He writes the wonderful poems about, you know, Condoleezza Rice and Obama and Michelle Obama and George Bush and John Roberts, and the list goes on. It's also a lot of memories of his family, and there are many, many food memories here because he likes to eat, which is a good thing. It's good to, you can trust people who like to eat, don't you think? So we're going to welcome phone calls. Did I give you the number? It's 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. You can send an email too. That is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Calvin Trillin is our guest. And the book we're talking about has just been released. Quite enough of Calvin Trillin, 40 years of funny stuff. He, of course, was a longtime staff writer at The New Yorker, the nation's deadline poet, and he has written many, many, many books and done a one-man off-Broadway show. We're welcoming phone calls for him at 800-486-8655. And the email is talk@wpr.org. Eugene from Viola, our first caller. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kathleen. People always ask you how you and to you and your guests, how are you getting along with the stock question. And the answer that I always have for it, well, I'm not below ground feeding the worms. Either that, I'm still above ground pushing a shadow, when it rains, I get wet. That's just my answers, and I figure it's a relevant answer for the simple reason I'm 72 years old. My health is still good. I'm not below ground feeding the worms.
All right, good for you. You have one of the stories is about phrases that are used. I mean, what comes to mind is enough's enough, Calvin.
Yeah, that has to do with a friend of mine who was whose husband died. She was raising her son by himself, and he was sort of a handful, and she put some rules on the refrigerator, and the only rule we could remember was, we could remember two rules. One of them was tone of voice, which doesn't sound like a rule because it doesn't have a verb in it, but it's definitely a rule.
Yes.
And the other one was rule number six, enough's enough. I pointed out that there was a bank robbery in, I think, Queens and somewhere in New York, and the bank was robbed for the second time. The guy got away, and he ran down the street, and a assistant manager, a woman of middle years, chased him out the door, tackled him, and was about to do him some real physical harm when the police rescued him. And they asked her why she behaved this way and said, well, it was already robbed once, and enough's enough. The poor robber had no idea that they felt that way at the bank. Should have been a little sign there. At this bank, enough's enough.
I love it.
Is a rule strictly enforced.
Right. Do you have any of those little messages in your house at all? Any of those little sayings that guide you?
No. There's nothing on the refrigerator at all. It's a
no.
It's a blank slate there.
No, I am amazed.
My grandchildren are on a bread box. So I'm not guiltless of putting things on with magnetic.
Why? It's so much fun to do that, Calvin.
Well, that I absolutely agree, but they just happen to fit very well on a big bread box.
I made the mistake. It wasn't a mistake. I really love Springfield, Illinois, because I love Abraham Lincoln. And they have all these gift shops and all these sayings from Lincoln. And I love each and every one. So I've got the, you know, Lincoln sayings in frames in the kitchen, magnets on the refrigerator.
Actually, in Kansas City, schools were segregated when I was a boy. I didn't actually realize that there wasn't any rhetoric attached to it, but the black high school was called Lincoln, and so was the black movie theater. And I always say I had to get to the East before I read. I thought Lincoln meant colored. I realized later he'd also been the president.
Thanks, Eugene, for the call. Marty in Douglas County. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good morning. Mr. Trillin, this is so great that you're on. I want to thank you for giving me an opportunity to impress the heck out of a bunch of friends some years ago when I recited at a dinner with a bunch of progressive, smart people, The Ballad of Private Lynch by heart, which was one of your deadline poems, and was just, I can still do it to this day. It's embedded in my brain. I can't remember what I did 10 minutes ago, but I can tell you the first three verses of that poem.
I don't even remember writing it, even though I can recite the University of Missouri fight song, but I don't remember writing that one.
Well, it started out, preferring death to getting caught. She emptied weapons as she fought. Do you remember that? Those stabbed and shot, she didn't flinch. She battled on, did Private Lynch. Or did she? Anyway.
Well, Private Lynch has a good name. My problem with poetry, with what we call deadline poetry for the nation, is the insistence of people with names that don't have good rhyme and meter going into public life, which I object to.
Well, I imagine Wolfowitz was a tough one.
Wolfowitz, I did write some poems about Wolfowitz, I think. I thought that Blagojevich was going to be hard. But it turned out that Blagojevich was fairly easy. I wrote a poem about Blagojevich, which I think I have right here. It's called On the Auctioning Off of Barack Obama's Senate Seat. It seemed to Rod Blagojevich a powerful appointment, which was his to make should make him rich. His plan turned out to have a glitch. Perhaps the feds had flipped a snitch. So much for Rod Blagojevich.
Well, thank you for all the great poetry. And I'm wondering if you would talk about the one-man show that you, the play that you did off-Broadway. I'd love to hear about that.
Yeah, I actually did two of them, one in the late 80s and one in around 1990. My daughters called them one-ham shows. it was fun, sort of. I did two-week engagements on each one of them. And we had a small theater, so we could say it was a sellout. And also, it started. It ended fairly early, and the theater was sort of down two or three flights. So, if a huge bomb came and bombed the rest of the city, and it destroyed everybody from cats and watching those things, when we walked out, the theater emptied. You wouldn't even have known it because we were deep underground. And it was, I sort of regretted I didn't buy a smoking jacket during that period so I could look at my post late in the day with a smoking jacket like real actors do, or I imagine real actors do. But otherwise, it was fun.
Which brings to mind the tuxedo story, which I do the same thing when I buy clothing sometimes and figure out how much it costs you to wear it. But you got down to... 40 cents, something.
I bought a tuxedo in college because of the newspaper used to have a banquet every year. It was black tie. And I sort of figured out how much it would cost to rent, and then I decided to buy one. It would be cheaper. And when I divided it up, but my tuxedo management scheme didn't even include the possibility of wearing it after college, so I kept amortizing it, and I would wear it occasionally to places where tuxedos weren't actually necessary, like a hog roast maybe, or meeting to plan the overthrow of the government by force and violence, places where you didn't really have to wear it.
Right.
But I was just trying to get the per wearing down. I got it down to about 65 cents once, I think.
That's great.
Then it got to be very kind of tatty looking. And my wife said, you have to get a new tuxedo. And I said, what's the matter with this tuxedo? And she said, it's threadbare. And I said, it's not threadbare. And she said, you can see the threads. They're bare. And so I went and looked for another one. They had gone up in price since 1953. But then she said, well, look at it this way. This one you have lasted you 35 years. This next one ought to do you. That's the sort of thing that's sort of cut into the joy of the evening.
Exactly. Exactly. Let's go back to another one of those poems. It's sort of hard for me to figure out whatever happened to this guy, except I did see him in Milwaukee in 2004, and he just looked a little too sharp to me. But what the heck happened to John Edwards?
Well, I do have a poem in here about John Edwards, and it's let me find it here. It's called
157, if you have
the
book.
Yeah, I got it here.
All right.
Yes, I know he's a mill worker's son, but there's Hollywood in that hair. That's the name of it. A country song about John Edwards. He grew up poor in Carolina Shore. He's not a fake. He comes from folks like us. I like the sound of what John Edwards says, but why is his hair the kind that plain won't muss? Yes, I know he's a mill worker's son, but there's Hollywood in that hair. Wax the corporations where it hurts. His plan is best for caring for the sick. His wife's a gem. We're nutty for the kids. But lordy, that man's pompadour's too slick. Yes, I know he's a mill worker's son, but there's Hollywood in that hair. Sure, I know he's got substance and grit, and judging by hair is not fair. Yes, I know he's a genuine guy, and there's plain people's values we share. Yes, I know he's a mill worker's son, but there's Hollywood in that hair.
I think we need to just start judging by hair. What do you think?
Well, then Perry would be president.
Yes. He has probably the best hair, although Romney's is not bad.
Romney's is not bad, but I remember I was at some event at the state house or where the governor's mansion, whatever you call it, in Texas during a book fair, and Pinky Friedman was there. He's a great character in Texas,
mm-hmm.
And he said, you've got to come and meet the governor just to see his hair. He took me in there. He later ran against the governor with what I think was one of the great campaign slogans, how hard could it be? That's a great slogan for running for governor.
It's a good slogan. What do you think both of them do? It's kind of the style, I guess. I don't know too much about what men do with dyeing their hair, but do they both kind of dye the top of it, and then you leave the sides a little bit gray to show that you've lived a while and you've done a few things?
I have less experience in that area than I wish I had, which is to say I don't have any hair on top to dye. So I don't know. I'm not an actual expert on that.
Okay. Please tell us, I love this story about this man, and I wonder if he ever found his girlfriend. The story of Fats Goldberg's Pizza Parlor.
Yeah, Fats Goldberg, alas, died a few years ago.
Oh.
Unhappy death. And, no, he never found the girl of his dreams, despite a lot of hanging around in museums hoping to pick people up. But he had a cheerful, funny life, but then a sad demise.
Yeah. Tell the story of his neon sign that made it to the Smithsonian?
Yeah, at the bicentennial, they had a neon sign exhibit at the Smithsonian in their bicentennial exhibition, their exhibit. And they took his sign, Goldberg's Pizzeria. He was very happy to be there. So he thought it was quite an honor to be in the Smithsonian. Of course, he replaced it with sign that said exactly the same thing.
Yeah, right. Calvin Trillin is our guest this hour. He has a new book, which is a collection of many of his writings over the past 40 years. Quite enough of Calvin Trillin, 40 years of funny stuff. We welcome your phone calls if you'd like to join the conversation. The book is brand new. I don't know if you've had a chance to read it, but these are a collection of 40 years worth of material, so I'm sure that you'll recognize some of them as you read it now. Our number is 800-486-8655 if you'd like to join the conversation. The email address here is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Calvin Trillin, our guest, and we go to Jane, who's on the road. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I would like to know whether Calvin was inspired by or knew or had any thoughts about the political poetry and works of Theodore Geisel, otherwise known as Dr. Seuss. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
Well, I love Dr. Seuss, and I read those books to my children, and I read them now to my grandchildren. I don't know about inspired. I think he's very talented, and he had a wonderful sort of pace to his verse. So you really want to read the next page. But he was a marvelous writer, and I've taken one of my grandsons to, I think it's called Horton Tells a Who or something like that, more times than I care to remember. It's better the first few times.
Do your grandchildren like to hear the same stories over and over?
Yeah, they particularly like stories that are embarrassing to their parents or their grandparents.
Ah.
I think all kids like them.
You wouldn't have any of those, though.
No.
No.
Those are classifying.
Yeah, right. Suggestions, this is a funny one, for states that don't have mottos, should Wisconsin have been Eat Cheese or Die?
Definitely. That was a time when people thought that Wisconsin was not sufficiently described by the license plate motto, America's Dairyland, and the eastern states had all these fancy mottos like the Empire State. New Hampshire had live free or die, and somebody suggested for Wisconsin, eat cheese or die. Some states in the Midwest don't have mottos at all. I suggested one for Nebraska, a long way across.
Which it is.
And for Arkansas, I suggested one that's a little wordy. I'm still working to cut it down to license plate size. It was Arkansas. Not as bad as you might have imagined.
But somebody surely should be able to pick up on enough's enough.
Yeah, enough's enough would be a good motto. I don't know which state would do that. Maybe Illinois, probably, with
right.
Political problem.
Right, enough's enough. Well, you're not a guy, well, forgive me, maybe you've really brushed up on your economics, but I know that you found it difficult to answer the question why the financial system nearly collapsed in the fall of 2008. Do you have a gap in your knowledge here? Do you go to experts to figure out what's going on with the economy? Do you have financial experts to help you with your finances?
It turned out that I was the expert in this case. Because I wrote a piece that what happened with the meltdown on Wall Street was that smart guys started going into Wall Street. It used to be, in my era, that the people who went to Wall Street were pretty much the lower third of the class. And they were pleasant guys, very presentable. And they weren't even greedy by today's standards. I mean, they wanted a nice house in Greenwich and maybe a sailboat.
Right. Who doesn't?
And everybody does that.
Right.
And then partly because tuition got so high in universities, so that even people from sort of upper middle class families ended up in debt. And partly because the money started to get so big on Wall Street that smart guys started to go down there.
Yeah.
And they're the ones who invented all this stuff like credit default swaps. I mean,
what the heck
is
that?
Guys couldn't have done credit default swaps. They couldn't do the math. I mean, they had no idea. And ironically, our guys were the ones in charge of the firms by that time. So all they knew is that they were getting filthy rich. Had no idea from what. So I wrote this piece, and I don't know, I just sort of made this up out of thin air. And then I got letters from emails and things from economists saying, finally, somebody has said what has happened. That is exactly what happened.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So sometimes,
that's wonderful.
Sometimes you do things accidentally. For instance, in 2006, I did a book explaining that the shoe bomber was a prank. According to my theory, I mean, I don't know if you read much about the shoe bomber. He was a guy named Richard Reed.
Yeah.
And he was described in the press as very, very impressionable. He was a convert. He wasn't a Muslim, an Arab. And he did it in such a clumsy way. He's such a bozo. I mean, he practically had the fuses hanging off of his sneakers when he went on, and I think he might have asked the flight attendant for a match. I mean, and so my theory was that there's one Arab terrorist with a sense of humor, and I wrote this in 2006. They called him Khalid the Droll, and he said to his cell, I bet I can get them all to take their shoes off in airports. So then he recruited this bozo, got him on the plane, and now everybody has to take their shoes off in airports. And I said in the piece, you'll know I'm right if the next person who's caught is called, because of his M.O., the underwear bomb.
Uh-huh.
Exactly what happened. So I think I had mentioned it on the Daily Show, and they replayed some of it in the moment of Zen, and my then six-year-old grandson saw a replay of it, and he said, Babo said underwear on television. So my stock went way up.
Oh, that's funny, Calvin. Let's go to Neil in Shorewood. Hi, Neil.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Real good. Real good. Mr. Trillin, lots of things I could ask, but a couple of them. I grew up in roughly the same time and place you did, and I recall at one point hearing you talk about small bug that is the bane of the Great Plains, chigger.
Ooh,
you're starting me to itch right now.
Oh, yeah. I know. I wonder if you could tell our listeners about that.
Well, chiggers, of course, were the most horrible part of my childhood. When I said I had a happy childhood, I guess I should have said, except for chiggers. Because chiggers are a bug that lives in the Midwest and the South, and particularly in tall grass, and they're microscopic, so you can't see them, and they enclose or no defense, and they like sort of creases and wet places and warm places, and their itch. I actually invented a unit of measurement to measure their itch, which is a millimoss, which is the itch power of 1,000 mosquito bites. And the average chigger has 8 millimoss of itches. And it lasts just short of eternity. And nothing can stop it. Amputation works sometimes, but not always. And, of course, people in the East don't even believe there is such a thing called a chigger. They think it's sort of an insect snipe that people from the Midwest use to pull the leg of Easterners. When I used to go home to Kansas City, and my high school friends would say, how can you live in New York? And I would say, there are no chiggers in New York. They say, not even in the tall grass. There isn't any tall grass in New York. So I think that's why a lot of Midwesterners live in New York, and a lot of Midwesterners are found all over the world, because particularly in July and August, because they're trying to get away. When I'm say, on the top of the Eiffel Tower, and next to me somebody from Joplin, Missouri, and they're looking out over the city, and you think, maybe they're thinking, wow, the City of Lights, what a gorgeous sight. What they're really thinking is, even if they got them over here, I bet they couldn't get up this high.
And yet there must be. See, although I know you don't trust these people, there's a funny bit on raccoons in the garbage can and this guy who tells you red onions. I would tell you, because I found clear nail polish to be effective against chiggers. I really have. And I've lived with them for a long time. And
well,
it's worked for me.
Nail polishes, there was a sort of a, one of the nostrums for chiggers when I was a kid was something called Chigger Rid, with two big R's in the middle. And it was essentially, I think, clear nail polish.
Uh-huh.
And I remember when it first came out, my mother, I guess it was a visiting day or something at Camp Osceola, BSA, Boy Scout of America. And my mother came down with some Chigger Rid, and she had more than one of them. And scouts were gathered around her. It looked like one of those scenes from just as the Nazis were getting to south of France and people were trying to get Portuguese visas or something, crowded around some poor Portuguese immigration guy, people hoping. But I don't think it really works. Somebody did a, somebody sent me a tear sheet from a medical magazine that said incidence of infections genitalia of prepubescent boys from chigger bites. And the research was done in Kansas City. I sent it to some of my high school friends and said, read it and weep.
Oh, thanks, Neil, very much for the call. Tom in Oconomowoc. Hi, Tom.
Hey, good morning to both of you. I have a little quick remedy I'd like to share here for the chiggers. This discussion takes me back to my childhood because my grandparents lived on a farm in Minnesota, and I remember them doing this to me, and it seemed to work, but it was such a long time ago. Maybe it didn't. I don't know. But they put a little drop of Elmer's glue over the chigger bite or whatever, and supposedly their logic was, and I don't know if this is medically based or not, but they said it kind of sealed the thing up and it just suffocated the whatever, the little
bug or something inside you.
So I don't know. I just remember that happening when I was a child.
Of course, you could find yourself stuck to the kitchen table that way, too.
We need to do a show on this kind of stuff. Wouldn't that be fun?
A chigger remedy show, I think, would be very popular.
Well, we'd have to.
I don't think you can work it in an hour. I think you'd need longer than
that. Do you think? Oh, I was thinking we needed something else, chigger remedies and some other kind of remedies. I don't know if I could carry an hour on it. I don't know. Have you ever won anything from the Publishers Clearinghouse?
I haven't, but it stands at the heart of my personal investment strategy.
That's what I read. I loved it.
Some people have criticized my personal investment strategy as being too dependent on Publishers Clearinghouse.
Yeah.
But no, I haven't. And, of course, now subscriptions to magazines are getting so they practically pay you to take it. So you don't even need Publishers Clearinghouse sweepstakes.
Right. Do you play? I just finished playing one of those from the grocery store. It was like a Monopoly game, and you all these little things, and I spent hours pasting them, and the glue didn't stick very well, and I didn't even win $2. I spent hours doing this. Didn't win a thing.
Some of the glue, though, would have been good for your chigger bite.
I didn't even think of it. Thank you. Next time there's a contest, I'll remember. Terry in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Oh, yeah, Mr. Trillin. I've had chiggers once in my life, and believe me, I'd rather turn to a brighter topic. I'm curious, since you're from Kansas City, what you think the best barbecue is around those parts. And I'll get off and listen so you can elaborate on it.
Thank you, Terry.
Well, the barbecue of my childhood was Brian's Barbecue, and so I still have sort of a loyalty, but I haven't been there. But that Mr. Brian died some years ago. Another one that people like is called LC's. Fats Goldberg, who we mentioned earlier in the program, went out to check LC's when it first opened, and he asked for a beef sandwich, and he said, put the sauce on the side. And LC said, that'll be 50 cents extra. And Fats was very impressed by that. He thought it was a real barbecue, right? Another popular one now is a place called Oklahoma Joe's, although it breaks a lot of my rules for barbecue. The most important one being that in Kansas City, unlike a place like Texas Hill Country, but in Kansas City, I've always said that going to a white-run barbecue is like going to a Gentile internist. things might turn out all right, but you're not playing the percentages. But Oklahoma Joe's has been very popular.
Thank you, Terry, very much for calling. Do you still do a lot of... do you still eat a lot?
Well, I eat about the same. I write about it a lot less. I never wrote about it very much compared to the general reporting that I've done. But it was always kind of a sideline. But now I write usually a piece every year for the New Yorker food issue.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about it. It originally started when I was doing a piece every 3 weeks for the New Yorker somewhere around the country, and they were mainly about controversies or murders or something. And at some point, I found that writing a piece about people's eating was a way of writing about the country in a lighter way, giving me a little comic relief
from
those stories. So that's how it began.
Yeah. Here's an email from Mike from Madison, who couldn't stay on the line. Wants to ask you about poetry. How do you master meter and rhyme in poetry? Can poetry be void of it? There is independent poetry in the Urdu language, for example.
Well, I mean, what my daughters would call grown-up poets certainly write poetry without any rhyme. What I write, I guess, would be called verse rather than poetry, really, or doggerel, maybe. Someone last year said to me, you could rhyme so-and-so's name with something. I can't remember what it was. And I said, well, it doesn't quite rhyme. And he said, well, almost rhymes. And I said, hey, rhyme's all I've got. I'm not in a position to give it up. I'm sorry. But I'm very strict about rhyme. My father, who was a menu poet. My father was a grocer for most of his working life, but he had a restaurant for a while, and he wrote poetry on the menu, mainly about pie.
Oh, I remember that.
The shortest one was Don't Sigh, Eat Pie.
Right.
But he was very good on rhyme, but he didn't care much about meter. One of my favorite of his poems was, eat your dinner, Mom said gently to her little son, Roddy. Don't, I'll break every bone in your body.
Well, we have a minute left. What should we talk about?
Well, I don't know. We could talk about poetry, and I could recite the poem that I did when George H.W. Bush left office.
Thank you. That would be just fitting fine.
All right, which is due to you, George Herbert Walker. Though never treasured as a talker, your predicates were often prone to wander noundless, off alone. You did your best in your own way, the way of Greenwich Country Day. So just relax and take your ease and never order Japanese.
Because the Undersecretary of State for Japan went to school with you. That's another funny piece.
That was, L. Dalton Durfee, the fourth dumbest guy in my class.
He did okay, though.
Yes, a lot of them did okay.
Yep, you don't have to be smart to do okay, huh?
That's true. I actually, at my 25th reunion, I said I had done a scientific survey using my usual controls and concluded that income is now precisely in inverse proportion to academic standing in the class.
Well, that make all of us at public radio feel much better about ourselves.
That's right. You guys were smart.
We were smart. Hey, we were smart. Well, I loved your book. It's just wonderful.
Thank you, Kathy.
And thank you for being with us. Have fun at the library.
Thanks.
Yeah, Calvin Trillin, our guest this hour. The book, his new book, is Quite Enough of Calvin Trillin, 40 Years of Funny Stuff. He, of course, and this goes back, some of these pieces go back some years, longtime staff writer at The New Yorker, also the nation's deadline poet, and he has written a number of books, and he is from Kansas City, lives in New York. Well, that was fun. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Good to be from the Midwest, isn't it? And that's it. Enough's enough. I'll be with you again on Monday at 9 o'clock for All Things Political. Have a wonderful weekend.